If you think about a chief executive officer, you really are leading the executives. That's your job. When you've got a team, you're leading that team. And the way you show up for that team and the way that you work the relationships in that team and the way that you interact with those individuals is everything. And the way that you get that team aligned and focused and working together, rowing in the same direction, that is the skill of the CEO.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. Welcome to the show. Today, Roland is speaking with Clate Mask. Clate is the entrepreneur, co-founder, and CEO of Infusionsoft and Keep. His company developed a SaaS product before that was even a thing. He's the co-author of the New York Times best-selling book, Conquer the Chaos, and a father of six children. His company is on a mission to simplify growth for millions of small businesses. But today, he shares pearls of wisdom from his own entrepreneurial journey for business leaders at every stage of the game.
Hey everybody, this is Roland Frazier with Business Lunch. I am excited to have here today my guest, Clate Mask from Keep, who is the co-founder and CEO. And Clate, tell us a little bit about what Keep is.
Yeah, you bet. Well, I should probably say it was formerly known as Infusionsoft, since many people know Infusionsoft. But Keep is sales and marketing software to help small businesses grow. And I think you know well, Infusionsoft for a long time was this powerful solution for small businesses to help them grow. But if you weren't very marketing savvy and if you weren't really into all of that power, it was overkill. And so we needed to create a lighter, easier version of the software. And last year we did that and then decided, you know what, since most people will start with that version of our software and then grow and graduate up potentially to Infusionsoft, we should probably give it its own name, and in fact decided we should give the company the name of that product and allow Infusionsoft to continue to be the high-end edition of our software for marketers and established small businesses that want all of the power of automation.
That's awesome. So now you started out, was it Mortgage Something Pro?
Oh yeah, yeah. So you're taking me the way back machine. Yeah, yeah. So we, years ago, before there was Infusionsoft, we created a CRM software in the mortgage industry. And the plan all along had been to go more broadly to small businesses, but we went with the mortgage solution first. And then a year later, we came out with what was then called Manage Pro CRM, and that became Infusionsoft.
So you're amazing because you've got really great pearls of wisdom for people at all stages of business. So let's talk about when you first had that idea that you wanted to do something. Did you have software programming experience or anything like that?
You know, I didn't. My two partners did. So the three of us were, you know, in the early days, the deal was basically they did nothing but write software and I did everything except write software. That was how the partnership worked.
Nice. And that's pretty cool because I'm a big advocate of partnerships. So tell me, like, how did you get involved? Was this something that you'd been kind of thinking about and then these guys just kind of happened to appear in your life? Or what's the genesis of idea to the first iteration of this company?
Yeah. So what happened was I had finished my MBA and was working at a software company out of state. And, you know, I was just doing business development and helping the software company get off the ground. And meanwhile, my wife's two younger brothers were down in Arizona, which is where we were from. And they were starting this custom software business and they were helping small businesses by writing custom software programs. And they would ask me all kinds of questions about the sales and marketing side. And I would be like, well, you got to do this and you got to do that. I would kind of coach them, advise them a little bit. And then eventually they said, hey, would you do this for us? And really I was just doing pay-per-click advertising. I mean, that's what it was back then. And that turned into a situation where they said, look, we need someone to do this full time. Would you be willing to come on board as an equal partner of the company and you do the sales and marketing and we'll write software? And so I looked at it and thought, you know, I think this is a good way to pay off my student debt. And, you know, I had $100,000 in student debt from business school and law school, and I had four kids at home, and I knew it was going to be a rough road, but I thought, you know what, we can build this thing up. And back then I thought, you know, we could build it up and sell it. And I could pay off all my student debt and have some money to invest or something like that. So on those naive auspices, I decided to join the company and be the sales and marketing person while they wrote software. And that was 17 years ago.
That's awesome. Now, how did it evolve into you being the CEO?
So in the early days, my partners, there were actually three of them that wrote software and myself. So there were four of us. We each owned 25% of the company. And it was really tricky in the early days, Roland, because there was this notion that, well, we should all be paid equally and everything should be equal equity. And I was like, look, I got all this student debt. I've got four kids. Like, I need to make more money. And they were like, no, we're not doing that.
They're like, we do too.
So, yeah, we'd like all that too. So we made equal for the first couple of years. We all paid ourselves equally. We ended up buying out that one partner. That's a whole story unto itself. But it was the three of us, and we each took home about, actually the deal was we were each going to take home $2,000 a month. Yes, 2,000 whopping dollars. That was the salary. And I said, look, I can't make it work with four kids on that. And so one of the partners said, all right, I'll take 1,500 and you can take 2,500, Clay. So that's what we did.
Nice.
And we each had equal equity. And I will tell you, Roland, those first 3 years were as hard as anything I could have imagined.
Yeah.
They were so difficult trying to get the business off the ground, morphing from a custom software business into a CRM product, into a web-based solution, first for mortgage professionals, then for small businesses generally. It was about a 3-year journey and it about killed me.
Yeah.
It was really tough.
Were the most surprising hard things?
You know, one thing that is tough is the business, it takes a while for the business income to translate into personal income.
Yes.
And especially when there are four partners. And so when you're dividing that four ways, it's really tough. And so we bought out one partner and then there were three of us, but it was custom software. And when I started with the company, about 75-80% of our revenues were from one customer. Mm-hmm. And that was tough. And so I went to work getting more clients so that we could diversify and have a base of customers. And by the time we got it to about 30%, that big client dropped off entirely overnight.
Man, that was good timing, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was pretty tough, but at least we'd gotten it down to 30%, you know, them being 30% of the revenue instead of, you know, 75-80%.
Now, did that client have a little bit of an interest in the company for a while as well?
You know, they didn't. They were doing leads in the mortgage industry.
Yeah.
We were doing a bunch of custom software for them, and they just took all of their software development offshore overnight. And so we went from bringing in $15,000 or $20,000 a month with them to nothing. But it took, you know, a year or so from the time I started to get us to the point that we had a bunch of other customers. But most of it was still custom software when that customer dropped off. And then that, mm-hmm. what that really did is it pushed us to get to where we had a product.
Okay.
And we looked at our software solutions we were creating for customers, and they all had a customer database at the heart of it. And we recognized that managing the customer relationship was critical. So we started to call it semi-custom CRM. And so we went from custom software to semi-custom CRM to CRM, where we would do a little bit of tweaking and customization, to then just a web-based SaaS product. It wasn't even called SaaS back then. I mean, this was
right.
The early 2000s. And so it was just web-based CRM. That's what it was.
So if you took the 2019 version of Clate back to those days, can you think of anything in particular that you would do differently approach-wise? Now, obviously, we'd all do things differently, but in approaching a business for somebody that might be where you were then, only it's now for them.
Yeah.
How would you help a younger you at that point?
You know, I would push to recurring revenue as quickly as possible.
Okay.
We kind of stumbled into it. We basically had these custom software projects. They were web-based, so we were hosting them. And so we called it a hosting fee.
Uh-huh.
But it was a really small piece of what we did. And so we had this little hosting revenue. And it started to become this, you know, $2,000-$4,000 a month. And we were like, hey, we get that hosting revenue no matter what. And so we started to shift our business more and more toward that subscription revenue. And I think the first, you know, it's so hard to do because you got to keep the lights on, and subscription revenue, you know, in the early days, it's really hard to get enough revenue to keep the lights on. I mean, to feed your family or whatever, you can't really do that on monthly subscriptions very easily. So what you have to do is you have to keep your expenses really, really low. This is me talking to my early self.
Right.
Anybody else out there, you got to keep your expenses really low and get the subscription revenue base up. And as you do that, you start to build a really nice, predictable business that has recurring revenue. So that's a big piece of advice. And today, that's maybe not novel advice. People are looking around at business models every day and saying, yeah, you know, that's the way to go. But it takes a lot of discipline to do it as an entrepreneur today. You got to keep your expenses really low. You got to do some smart, savvy things in order to get cash flow up so that you can make it work on a subscription revenue.
How about somebody where that revenue just isn't enough to help them? They've got four kids and they're trying to make it and they just can't do it that way, but they don't want to bring in outside money. Do you recommend that they just bite the bullet and bring that outside money? Or do you think that it's good to create maybe another product so you have some kind of short-term higher income thing, even if it won't scale or won't last, but it covers you for this time? Or is that too much of a distraction?
Billy, that last part's the great question. Is it too much of a distraction? What most entrepreneurs do that I see, that I advise, that we, you know, our customers, they'll have a service revenue piece of the business that brings in higher dollars today that they can pay the mortgage with today.
Right.
And then they'll have the subscription revenue business that they're trying to get up off the ground and get to a point where it can eclipse the service revenue and it can become the business. Mm-hmm. The real question, as you said, is it too much of a distraction? And what happens is you start to become beholden to that revenue that's paying the bills, that service revenue, and it becomes very, very difficult to get the subscription revenue going. So another technique that a lot of people will use is they'll get a line of credit or a mortgage on their house, or they'll use credit cards, but they'll use consumer debt in some way to get enough cash flow in order to get the subscription revenue business off the ground. So if you think about subscription revenue and service revenue and then plugging the holes a little bit with debt, where you're always conscious of the real business is the subscription business, not mm-hmm. the service business. If you can do that and accelerate that shift to the subscription business as fast as possible, then you'll be in a much better place.
Nice. So you ultimately decided to get funding. Like, what's the timeline of funding from Infusionsoft to Keep?
So we didn't raise capital until we'd been in business about 5 years. And I think that's one thing a lot of people don't realize. We bootstrapped it. We got the business to about $5-6 million per year in revenue when we raised capital. And getting it to that point, you know, those first 3 years were just brutally difficult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you asked, well, what advice would I give to, you know, an entrepreneur that's in that process? You know, you're trying to get it to subscription. It's just perseverance and tenacity. And, you know, I just think about those first 3 years, and every day was just a struggle to make it to the next day. And, mm-hmm. you know, I remember getting about 2 years in and realizing, okay, we'd started using our software to do automated follow-up with our prospects and customers. And so we had started to see the benefits of it. And I saw how game-changing it was to do automated follow-up with our prospects. And so I was in full belief mode. By the way, I had gone through my dark times where I was like, I don't know if this thing's going to make it. But I'd gotten past that and I was in, you know, I knew it was going to work.
Right.
But like I said, at the very outset of our conversation, it was taking longer for the business revenue to turn into, or, you know, the business income to turn into personal income.
Sure.
And so my wife was saying, hey, you know, I'd say it's getting better. She's like, well, it's not getting better for us. You know, like this is not going well. And she finally had gotten to a point where she was like, you know what, you got to promise me you'll go look for a job tomorrow when you go to the office. And I said, you know, I persuaded her over and over, you know, let's hang in there. We can do this. And this time she was done. You know, she's like, I can't do it anymore. And, you know, I look back and I can't blame her a bit, as she's so supportive. She's so amazing. But we had four kids. We had about $100,000 of student debt. We were getting deeper and deeper into credit card debt. You know, creditors were banging on the door. We were as close as you can be to bankruptcy. And I was really kind of in denial financially, because I was like, hey, the business is going to work. We'd put 2 years into it. I believed it was going to work. Mm-hmm. But that night I wasn't going to win the argument, and I just said, okay, I will look for a job when I go to work tomorrow. Oof. So the next day I went into the office, and just like, you know, that reaction you have where as an entrepreneur, you've put a couple years of blood, sweat, and tears in it, and you actually believe it's going to work now. You're to the point where you're like, no, I know this is going to work.
Right.
Your spouse is saying, I can't do it anymore. And, you know, that's a really tough place for entrepreneurs to be. Yeah, and I went into the office that day with every intention of looking for a job and keeping my promise to my wife. But I just sat down and started to deal with the leads and the prospects and doing all the stuff that I did every day. And before I knew it, the day was over and I hadn't done a bit of job hunting. And so I drove home and I was just thinking, crap, you know, I don't know, what am I going to tell Charisse? I felt awful that I hadn't, you know, done what I said I was going to do. And so many entrepreneurs, the work had just swallowed me that day. And I was driving home and just kind of worried and nervous about what I was going to say. Frankly, I was scared. And I walked into the house and we'll never, ever forget that day. Charisse was, you know, her back was to me. I walked in, she turned around and she said, "Hey, did you look for a job today?" And I said, "No." And there was kind of a pause. And she walked toward me and she just gave me a huge hug. And she said, "You know what? Everything's going to be okay. Just keep going."
And, oh man, that's so nice.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I, you know, we literally just hugged and held each other tight. And, you know, and I said, what has happened? She goes, "You know what? God knows what's happening with us. We're going to be okay. Just keep going." And, you know, that keep going story for me is really personal, but it's, you know, every entrepreneur that's successful has a keep going story, if not two or three or 10 or 20, right?
Right.
And so, you know, therein lies the reasoning and the meaning behind our brand of keep. You know, our message to entrepreneurs is keep going, keep serving, keep growing. And our brand that we'll be building for years to come is keep. And we did that because it's a simple, easy, memorable word that's in the language. It spreads really nicely. And it helps us to take our product and our message, the vision of where we're going. But it all is grounded in that challenge of being an entrepreneur that everybody feels, and you got to keep going.
That's awesome. So at that point now, you guys have decided you've got her buy-in, your buy-in to the company, you guys are all in. When does it get easier, or when does funding come in, and how does that decision come about?
We will be right back with more of Clate's amazing story in just a sec. But first, if you're wanting to go to the next level with the kinds of growth strategies we talk about on Business Lunch, then there's actually an opportunity to get to work with Roland. He's going to be teaching some intensives in the next few months. These are two-day, in-person, intimate workshops where you and about 20 other business owners will deep dive into 30-plus core strategies to implement into your business. Here's Roland to tell you more about it.
So if you want to grow your company's revenue, profits, and valuation, then this is probably going to be one of the most important events you ever attend. Nobody teaches this stuff, and very few people in the world actually have the experience of completing the number of deals across the breadth of industry needed to know how. So I've founded, owned, grown, leveraged, scaled, and or sold over 24 different businesses across an equal number of industries, and sales were ranging anywhere from $1 million all the way up to a couple of $1 billion. And in this rapid paced intensive, you're going to learn a whole bunch of things, including how to achieve your 3-year growth goals in the next 12 months, what to do to overcome growth stalls to reactivate revenue and profit compounding. We're going to talk about how to find leverage to radically decrease your need for outside capital and the accompanying dilution of your equity to fund your growth. 8 ways to acquire other businesses for little or no money down, one of my favorite things to do. 7 ways to grow your business 10 times through acquisitions. How to sell your company and retain control, like we recently did, and also Phil Knight of Nike and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. Also, 5 key strategies that we learned from our time with Richard Branson that he used to build 12 different billion-dollar companies in the Virgin Group. Also talk about the best tool that you can start using today to avoid overwhelm and laser focus your growth team on moving the correct 5 levers of growth. 14 quick wins that can easily 10x your business. The complete exit process and negotiating tactics learned from the trenches in thousands of public and private company deals. Our proven strategy that's guaranteed to 5 times your lead flow, and a whole lot more. I hope to see you there.
So if you're interested, shoot us an email at support@wrmembers.com. That's support@wrmembers.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
About 6 months later, we started to see the business results. You know, things were really getting better at home, not just at work. We started to be able to, you know, pay our bills and that sort of thing. And then for a couple of years, we grew the business. You know, we were serving direct response marketers. That was kind of our beachhead. We were really working with those marketing savvy small businesses that wanted to keep straight their prospects and customers. And the business was growing. And yet, I didn't believe it was the kind of business at that point that we should go out and raise capital, because, you know, we had this nice business. It was a good lifestyle business. Frankly, I still felt like, hey, let's run it for a couple more years and then sell it. Mm-hmm. But what happened was the business continued to grow, and we started to recognize that this CRM software, this sales and marketing software for small businesses, was needed across the board. It wasn't just with savvy marketers. And we caught a vision of what we could do for small businesses, because we knew that this sales and marketing automation was a total game changer. Mm-hmm. And so after about two more years of running the business, we raised our sights and said, you know what, we literally, Roland, felt like we had a responsibility to small businesses. And as corny as that may sound, that's really what it was inside of us.
No, that's great.
It was like, we saw what was happening for our customers that did it. We saw what had happened when we put this automated follow-up in place in our business. And we wanted to take that to the world of small businesses, and we wanted to change the world for small business. And it was at that point when we had a big world-changing vision that we said we should raise capital. And okay. The reason I give that context is a lot of entrepreneurs think, oh, well, let's go raise capital. And it's like, well, I tell people all the time, don't do it unless you've got a really big vision that requires capital.
So I want to hop into the back of that, but since you mentioned the balance between business income showing up personally, and that's a big challenge for a lot of people. The challenge that I hear from people most often is, well, I started my business and then I need money to get customers, and then I need people to serve the customers that I get, or systems, and then I might need inventory or development. Like, right. those are the two big kind of costs there. And then I have to go buy more media to get more customers and get more people to serve them. And I never get out of the cycle of that to really take any serious money home. How did you deal with that?
So, you know, for us, it was a tricky balance, because we had this big vision and we were always investing back into the business.
Right.
And I think the biggest thing is you have to understand the relation between your personal income, your personal take home pay, and the vision you have for the business. Because if you have a long-term vision of what you're trying to do, then you need to temper your current cash demands, you know, personally, and keep your take-home pay relatively modest so that you can invest in the business and grow the business. Now, if you have a different business model where you're like, you know what, I'm in this for a couple of years, then you should be maximizing the take-home pay all you can. So the personal income really depends on your vision. And for us, we had a very long-term vision. And so I was comfortable with gradually increasing the pay over time, and my partners. But, you know, it was tough at times, especially when we were serving, you know, in those earlier days, all of our customers were these direct response marketers, info marketers. It was all about take-home pay. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'd look at it and say, you know, we're taking home $100,000 in those earlier days a year. You know, we got past the $2,000 or $3,000 a month. You'll be happy to know. You know,
nice. All right.
Therese was very happy about that. But, you know, we were taking home six figures. It was enough to, you know, provide for our families, and it was fine. But we weren't getting rich off it by any stretch. But what was happening is the equity of the business was becoming more and more and more valuable.
Sure.
And that's what I mean by the long term. You have to look at the equity value of the business and the long term equity value versus the current short term income that you're taking home. And, you know, over time, we've continued to increase the salary and the equity has grown. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the succinct answer to entrepreneurs is, don't just look at take-home pay, look at the equity value of the business. Don't just look at the short-term, look at the long-term as well. And then adjust your current income based on what your long-term and equity desires are.
Did you have a formula then, or did you just basically say, this is the minimum that we need to get by while we're investing and building the wealth in the company? What were the discussions like when you were getting together trying to decide how to figure out what to take home versus what to reinvest?
It was somewhere in between that. It wasn't just like the bare minimum. It was, you know, we had lived off the bare minimum for a long time, so we wanted to pay ourselves a little bit more. But we came up with what we felt like was a reasonable salary for that stage of our lives, mm-hmm. and then said, let's give ourselves incentives that if we accomplish A or B or C, then, you know, we have a bonus that we take home, or we do something, you know, special.
Nice. Okay, cool. So now you've got that, you're building the equity, you're reinvesting, and you decide you want to do it. A lot of people that you want to fund, lot of people would say, how the heck do you start with, and maybe you didn't start with them, but I know you ended up with Goldman Sachs and Bain, which are two of the most prestigious investment banking outfits on the planet.
Right.
how does one go from where you were to landing those kinds of partners?
The short answer is you keep growing. You know, as you grow the business, then more and more reputable investors get excited about what you're doing. So that's the short answer.
Okay.
The longer answer is, you know, it's a stair step. And the first investor that came on board was a very reputable Silicon Valley venture capital firm. But the reason they came on board is because we were already at $6 million in annual revenue.
You weren't really a venture capital play at that point, were you? You were more of a growth capital play.
Yeah, back then it was venture capital. Today, in today's world, that would have been a little bit more growth capital. But
okay.
What you're hitting on, and maybe you're, you know, for the benefit of your listeners that may not understand the nuance that you just touched on, most venture capital firms are not putting their first round of funding into a company that's already at $6-7 million, you know, $6 or $7 million of annual revenue. That's almost unheard of. And so, yeah, we were a little different even back then. Today, it's even more the case because venture capital, you know, is thrown at ideas and very, very early businesses. But if you're not in Silicon Valley, you do have to have more revenue. You have to be a little more proven, not all the way to the point of $6 or $7 million. You know, today when entrepreneurs come to me and they're asking for advice about raising capital and, you know, they're bemoaning how hard it is and they've got, you know, $500,000 a year in sales, I'm like, you should try raising venture capital when you've got, you know, nothing. Or in my case, we were at $4 or $5 million, and you know, it wasn't just thrown at us left and right. I mean, things have changed quite a bit. You can raise capital a little easier now than you could back then.
Sure.
But the underlying message is you got to have a growing business. And when you have a growing business, investors get excited.
What kind of growth are they looking for?
A venture capital firm in the early stages wants to see a business that's doubling every year. I mean, that's generally what they want to see. If you're not doing that, then you have to have a higher revenue base that you're growing off of. In other words, if you've got $6 million a year in revenue, you may not have to be growing to $12 million the following year because you've already got six. If you're at $200,000, you better be at least $400,000 the next year, but more likely Sure. You need to be higher. So, you know, that you just need to be growing fast. But you also have to have a big vision and something they're going after. Because as you know, they want to put money into something that has a chance to be a $100 million a year business. And if it doesn't have that chance, they don't want to put their money into your business.
Right. And so there were two interesting books that came out relatively recently. One was Phil Knight's story of how he built Nike. And the other was Chip Wilson's on how he built Lululemon. And they both mm-hmm. had really interesting takeaways from like how they would do it going back, particularly Wilson, who ultimately lost control of Lululemon. Any takeaways from the experience of funding that you would give as advice to people who are concerned about continuing to have control, continuing to have the vision, worried about covenants or other people on the board and stuff like that?
It's a tricky world. having been through it for 10 years now, I understand why people are concerned about it. You have to understand that when an investor comes on board, they want growth. Mm-hmm. And you know, the hard thing is you have to, if you're taking on their money, you have to be in total growth mode. And so that requires some tough decisions. It requires, you know, letting go of people that maybe otherwise you wouldn't have let go of. It requires a lot of, you know, just a lot of vision for what you're doing long term, because if you don't maintain that vision and keep that growth and make those hard personnel moves, then you lose the support of your board members and your investors, and that's obviously problematic. So, you know, I've been through some of those things. It's challenging. The point you make to people is if you want to maintain control, then you got to grow.
Yeah. Yeah. So have there been, or is it typical for when you bring in money like that, if you don't hit certain growth numbers, that bad things happen or changes
yeah.
happen?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've been through that over the years at times where, you know, the tricky thing is that long-term growth doesn't usually happen in a straight line. It happens in sort of stair-step fashion.
Right.
And, you know, you think about that growth curve, it you know, oh, that it were so simple and smooth, you know, up and to the right, but it's just not. And that's where you've got to be really good as an entrepreneur in communicating and helping your board understand what you're going through and what's happening right now. Right. As you're going through a plateau before the next, you know, the next uptick. But, you know, you also have to be, as you work with investors, you got to be very self-aware. You got to work on yourself. You got to improve. You got to grow. You've got a boss, you know, that's the reality. And most entrepreneurs don't want a boss. And so most entrepreneurs shouldn't raise capital. That's the short answer.
It's a good answer. I don't think a lot of people think about that. That's an option to not do that.
Yeah. Yeah. If the only reason to do it is if you've got a big vision that requires capital. That is the only reason to do it, in my opinion. It's sometimes entrepreneurs will do it because they think, well, you know, I'm going to get some money. I'm going to take some chips off the table. You know, that usually is going to cause you more frustration if that's your reason for doing it. It's going to cause you to go sideways with your investors. So I don't advise people to raise capital because they want to, quote unquote, take some chips off the table. Now, if they're raising capital as part of a big vision and they got an opportunity to sell some shares and take some chips off the table, I do advise them to do that. I think that's a good idea. But that shouldn't be the motivation for raising capital. You should do it because you got a big vision that requires capital to move fast. And you know, that's the reason you want to bring investors into a boardroom.
So one of the things that you and I talked about at Genius Network one time was you were talking about the challenges in finding the right team and talent and having to let people go that hadn't already been to the next plateau, to the next place that you want to get. Would you talk a little bit about that challenge and also how, just in the context of how do you build that team that takes you to nine figures and beyond?
It's one of the things that's hard about raising capital and having investors is you're signed up for fast growth. And that means that you tend to outgrow the people that got you to a certain stage. And as you know, I talk all the time about the stages of revenue. They happen at the ones and the threes.
Yep.
You know, at 100,000, 300,000, 1 million, 3 million, 10 million, 30 million, 100 million, and so on. And for whatever reason, you know, I've just studied business for a long time. And that's how, you know, the growth stages happen that way. And you tend to see plateaus at those stages on the ones and threes of revenue. You tend to see people, systems, strategy changes. There's just a lot that shifts in order to move through to the next stage. And a lot of times entrepreneurs get stuck in those stages and don't realize what's happening. But it's a matter of adjusting their people, process, and systems. Mm-hmm. And so you have to understand as an entrepreneur that your good people will help you grow a stage. Great people will help you grow two stages. You know, that means that you're basically going from you're 10xing the business with great people. You're going from 1 million to 10 million. But it's a very, very rare person that can grow with you three stages or more. Mm-hmm. Now, I tell people that so they understand that's the realities of what we're up against. And there's a rare unicorn that can beat the odds and say, oh no, you watch. And by the way, they might stay in the business, but they can't stay in that same role. Usually they just can't keep up with that leadership role because things are changing so much. And the desire to improve yourself and adjust and get better is usually just not sufficient to grow more than 10x with a company in a leadership role. You stop and think about that. You know, if a listener's got a business that's 3 million and they brought on a person that's going to help them grow to 30 million as their VP of customer service, let's call it, the entrepreneur would probably be thrilled with a person that could help them grow from 3 to 30. And it's not likely that that person's going to help them grow beyond. And it's probably more likely that they're going to help them grow from about 3 to 10. And then, you know, after they go through that stage change, it's going to be time for a new leader. Mm-hmm. But that's just a business reality. I wish it weren't true because I'm a believer in people and I always want to believe people can grow and improve. But if you're going to grow fast, especially, then you're going to, then who got you here won't get you there.
So how do you know when you're at that point? When somebody's kind of gone as far as they can go?
Things start to go off a little bit in their area of the business.
Okay.
They start to become much more reactive instead of leading with a plan that confidently is driving the function of the business forward. You a lot of times see stagnation in the growth of the business, and many times it's related to that function. You see that person less confident. You see that person less energetic. You know, they start to get tired. They start to get a little bit beaten down. And, you know, those are just some of the signs. And if, you know, as a good leader, you've got to be working with that person and helping them understand where they are and what challenges they need to overcome in order to break through to the next stage. And, you know, some will be able to do it. But like I said, most good people will take you one stage. Great people will take you two. It's a rare exception that'll take you three.
How do you find the next stage person? And then also, how do you make that transition?
The short answer is you need people who have had experience growing a business from the stage you're in to the next stage.
Okay.
The biggest mistake CEOs make, entrepreneurs make in hiring people is they go get quote unquote experienced people who have either been in a company that's two or three or four stages beyond where you are. And then they hire that person and then say, oh, that didn't work out. That was a big company person that didn't work in our company. Mm. Or the other version, the other flavor of the mistake is they hire a person who's been at the stage just beyond where you are. If you're at a $1 million company, you want somebody that's been at the $3 million company. But what you need is a person who helped grow from one to 3 million, not somebody who was at 3 million.
Right.
Because you need someone that's been through that growth phase. And what happens a lot of times is the mistake is either you hire somebody that's two or three or four stages beyond. So if mm-hmm. you're at a million, you're hiring somebody that's been at 30 million or 40 million. Or if you're a $10 million company, you're hiring somebody that's been at a, you know, $300 million company or a $100 million company. That's mistake number one. Mistake number two is you hire a person that didn't actually go through the growth phase, but they were at that company, you know, that was a stage ahead of you.
Do you mean that they were just kind of like right place, right time and didn't actually have the impact, or that they came in after that growth occurred and therefore they didn't really do the growth?
Both versions. That's a good point. I was referring specifically to they came in after that stage of growth.
Got it. Okay.
But sometimes it is that, you know, they were not the person driving the growth.
I've seen that a lot. It's really hard. That's hard because it's like they were there and because of liability, the people you're asking about them are like, you know, yeah, they were here.
Yeah, they were here.
Yes. So you really have to figure out, I guess, like, you know, what was the plan? And it's like when you're asking somebody how they came up with a song or a story, you know, it's like, well, what inspired you for that? Or what did, you know, how did that happen? And then really get the nitty gritty from them instead of just trusting that just because they happen to be the CEO or CMO or whatever, you know, department responsibility you're looking for, that they actually did have that impact themselves, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, for the listeners, if you want kind of a three-step checklist on getting the right leader, you know, your question was, how do you get that leader at the next stage?
Yeah.
Number one, you find someone who's been one stage beyond you. Number two, you make sure that they were there through the growth from where you are to where that company is. Mm-hmm. And then number three, you dig into, like you said, Roland, okay, well, what motivates you? What drives you? What is it that caused you to help drive the growth of the company? And you can get a sense for whether the person was riding the coattails of the team or was actually leading the charge.
Right. So when the person that the company has outgrown someone at a stage, so they can't really get it to the next, how do you make that transition? What's that conversation like? That's rough because it's like friends and people that you know, even, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've been through this with a bunch of some great friends. You know, it's still painful to me to have gone through it. And sometimes you make mistakes. You know, I look back and there was a time where I let a team member go. And I look back and I realize the challenge we were having was more upstream in product, not where we were in letting this person go. And I've since had lunch with that person and fessed up and said, look, I made a mistake. If I'd done it over, I would have gone and solved the problem at the product level, which is, you know, and I said this before, but the thing was, we got to a point where our growth slowed because the cost and complexity of our solution sort of had us in a narrow segment of the market, and we were trying to be more broad, mm-hmm. but the marketing leader didn't have the lighter, easier version of our product to take to the market in a way. So I ended up removing the marketing leader. And over time I realized, you know, I really should have made the adjustment on the product side, which I eventually did. Mm-hmm. And that obviously, you know, drove the product development and drove to the point that we have Keep today, because we needed to open up the market in order to achieve the vision that we have for the company to simplify growth for millions of small businesses. Well, the marketing leader couldn't do it with the product set that we had at the time. We needed to have a lighter, easier version of the software so that we could go to the market in the way that we're now going to the market.
Okay, I want to ask you about that after I ask you this.
Okay.
What do you do as a CEO? You've been there from zero through lots of ones and threes. You're over 100 now, right?
That's right.
How do you grow? How do you ensure that you're able to grow along with the business? What do you do to do that?
A lot of times people will say, well, Clay, you know, if who got you here won't get you there, then, you know, you got to replace you too, right?
Right.
And that's a possibility, right? You, as the leader of the company, you have to look at it and say, maybe, you know, maybe that needs to happen.
But frequently not, right?
But frequently not.
Lots of CEOs go from, or founders go from, you know, nothing to, but and we usually, it seems like they get rid of the founder, or the founder steps down from CEO, like Howard Schultz at Starbucks, or Steve Jobs at Apple.
Yeah, my take is twofold. First, the CEO entrepreneur has something special in their bones that's different than the rest of the team. And it's not that they're better. It's that fire that lives inside of the founder drives them to learn and grow and improve at a rate that most of the team members aren't willing to do.
Right.
And so it's not that you're better. I mean, if you took me and put me on a team in another company, I wouldn't grow at the same rate.
Yeah.
But because it's my company, I grow at a different rate. I've got a fire inside of me to get better. And so one, you've got something different inside of the entrepreneur. And the second thing is that different thing causes them to seek out learning, growth, development, improvement, and take that on at a rate that most people aren't willing to do. So now to answer your question, what do I do? Well, I do coaching. I read books I read 6 books a quarter. I go to all kinds of different programs. I learn. I keep my ears open. I listen to my wife a lot.
That's a really good barometer, man. Your spouse is super smart. I'm telling you.
Yes. Yes. She truly, like, you know, I pay a lot of money for an executive coach, but I tell my coach, I tell my wife, I tell anybody that'll listen that by far my best advisor is my wife. You know, she knows me, she watches me, she understands, and she just has insights into how I'm acting and how I'm behaving that if I'm humble and I listen, it makes a great difference in my work relationships and in the business.
Yeah.
If I'm not humble and I don't listen, I kind of get my butt kicked, and that's happened enough times that I'm now humble and I listen.
Then you get your butt kicked on the business side and the family.
That's right.
So now the executive coach to me is an interesting thing because, when you're running a $100 million plus company, the pool of qualified coaches has got to be small. And there's so many people out there that I think just honestly are charlatans about where they've done and, you know, what they've done. How do you find a coach? I'll ask 2 questions because that seems to be the theme today. How do you find a coach for somebody like you that's at such an, you know, you've got major, major players as partners. You've got all these complex financial and legal and marketing issues, and you're at 9 figures looking at all kinds of possibilities of, you know, exits and things like that, and hopefully growing to 10 figures. Where do you find that person?
Yeah. You know, I started working with my coach about 9 years ago, and he had run a business as the president of a company that was far bigger than ours. It was about a $50 million, maybe $70 million business. And so back then it was much bigger than ours. Mm-hmm. And that was a really important factor for me. I wanted someone who had kind of seen what was ahead. I worked with him for several years, and then a couple of years ago stopped working with him, in large part because I was feeling like, okay, I need to find a coach who's been at that next stage, who's been beyond.
Right.
And I did a couple of different coaching things, but they didn't work as well, to be totally honest. Mm-hmm. And I now am back this year with the coach that I spent all those years with. And what I found was it's much more about self-awareness and the insightfulness of the coach to see things and help me see things in my relationships. It's much more about that than it is about, you know, advising me on the business model or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You can go find different advisors for that kind of stuff. But a personal coach, an executive coach, it's a very, very personal thing. And, you know, I've now been working with him again for the past 6 months, it's been fantastic. You know, I look at the couple of years that I took off, and frankly, I think it was a mistake. I think I had this notion that, oh, I need to go find a coach that has run a company that's bigger. And, I think coaching is a little different. It's more about self-awareness. It's more about seeing things in your relationships and ways you can adjust and change things for the better that really just requires a very effective partner that knows you well and that you bring into your life in a way that you're willing to get very vulnerable and very close with that person, and that that person can kind of tell you stuff nobody else can tell you.
I think that's a really great insight, and it's cool to watch you light up when you talk about it, because it's clear that it, you know, like, I'm back. It's really awesome to have this resource back again. Would you mind sharing not necessarily what the advice was or anything too personal, but just so people can understand, because I think what you said is very, very, a very big thing that a lot of people might gloss over because they're focused on business models and KPIs and all this other stuff. If you had to pick with this coach an area or a kind of thing that he or she's helped you with the most, what would that be?
Leading a team.
Okay.
Leading individuals. When you get to the point that you've got hundreds of employees and you've got an executive team, your job, we use this CEO title often interchangeably with entrepreneurs, and I'm okay with that. I'm not one that's like, that's not really a CEO. But if you think about a chief executive officer, you really are leading the executives. That's your job. Mm-hmm. It's not your job to make decisions on, you know, what marketing program are we going to do? That's not the job anymore. When you've got a team, you're leading that team, and the way you show up for that team and the way that you work the relationships in that team and the way that you interact with those individuals is everything. And the way that you get that team aligned and focused and working together, rowing in the same direction, that is the skill of the CEO. It's to get everybody focused on the vision, get everybody aligned and rowing in the same direction, and making sure that the company has the resources that it needs to go accomplish its goals. That's what the CEO does. Set the vision, build the team, and make sure you got the resources. That is the CEO job. And so when you think about that job, it's all about your interactions with that executive team. And I have made lots of mistakes in my interactions with the team over the years, and I've learned a lot. Mm-hmm. And, what I do with my coach is, I walk in the room. It's not like we have this set agenda, and he says, okay, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And I talk to him about what's going on. And most of the time, what he's doing is he's helping me see how the way that I'm behaving is either helping us get the results we want or preventing us from getting the results we want.
Mm-hmm. Is it frustrating when sometimes you're not having the behavior that's getting you?
Yeah, sure. It's not for the faint of heart. I spend a lot of money with a coach to, he very caringly helps me see it. You know, it's not like there have been times he's shaken me by the lapels. There have been times, but he's usually in a very caring way helping me to see something that I wasn't seeing.
That's great.
And in the process of talking it out, I kind of discover it. And I'm like, oh, so I'm usually together we come up with, here's what needs to happen with Scott or with Keith or, with Carrie. It's hard to explain, but it's really about relationships and about leadership. And that all starts with looking in the mirror.
That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Keep. And I wasn't actually aware of this pivot. I knew the name change, but I know a lot of people that I've talked to we don't know why it changed. And your explanation is really, really great. And I love the origin story of the name too. Just so that everybody that's listening gets it, Infusionsoft was a super robust, rich, all kinds of nooks and crannies to go down into resource and solution. And Keep is a lighter, easier to understand and implement version. Is that a fair description?
That's a fair description. The only thing I would say is with Infusionsoft, it's not that it was, it is.
Okay, so are they still both around?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So we have,
if I go to infusionsoft.com, I think it forwards to Keep, doesn't it?
It goes to Keep. And then you, if you go to, like, you look at the pricing page or throughout the site, you'll see Infusionsoft is our high-end software.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that either. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. I think it's a lot. I'm glad you asked me the question. I told you the story, but I didn't tell you why we decided to change the name of the company. You know, mm-hmm. I said we had a new product and we decided to have the product name be the name of the company, but here's why. At the beginning of 2017, we started on our new mission. I don't know if you're aware, but we had a 10-year mission that went from the time we raised capital until, actually it was about a year before we raised capital. That's when we started the vision. But that 10-year mission ended going into 2017. And so we started on the new mission.
Was that the 100 million? I remember the flags at your
headquarters
that had.
Yes, that was the 100,000 customers, and you know, the 10-year mission that we were on, basically getting to a $100 million business. Yes, you're exactly right. We call it the Everest mission. So when we got toward the end of that, we said, "All right, it's time for us to go to what's next." And what's next is the Mars mission, mm-hmm. and the Mars mission takes us through the year 2030. And it's to simplify growth for 5 million small businesses worldwide.
Nice.
Well, when we set that mission, we knew, okay, we've got to now do what the market's been asking for a while, which is to create a lighter, easier version of Infusionsoft, because we can't get to 5 million customers served on the powerful, you know, the powerful solution that Infusionsoft is. We couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And so we said, all right, that product will continue to live on, and we need to create a lighter version, a lighter, easier version of it. So that's what Keep is. We have Keep Grow and Keep Pro, and then we have Infusionsoft at the high end. And down the road, we'll have, you know, a product called Keep Simple. So it'll go Simple, Grow, Pro, Infusionsoft. And that's our product line now. And so finally, we are in a place where we can say to small businesses, we're the platform to help you grow. Wherever you are in your stage of growth, there's an edition of the software that's right for you. You can grow with us over time. If you want to start, you know, if you're a more marketing savvy business or a much more established business, you can start with Infusionsoft from the beginning so that you get all of the power of our automation. But if you want light automation and you prioritize ease of use, you can start on the low end and then add more powerful automation as you grow with us.
That's fantastic. And so what do you see, like, where are things going for businesses and CRMs and in the future between now and 2030?
Well, definitely to the phone. You know, Keep is built as mobile first. So it's all, you know, if a customer goes and gets a free trial of Keep Grow, they're going to have primarily a handheld experience with our software. Another part of it is it's very integrated. You know, you can't have a bunch of different solutions. So you need it all together in one system. That's obviously a huge part of what we built. And then it's got to be really easy. You know, most small businesses want ease and then want to layer on power over time as they start to understand, oh, wow, this automation is amazing. Mm-hmm. I want to do more of that. But, you know, unless they're very process-oriented, marketing-oriented thinkers, they don't lay out the process and automate it from the beginning. They
Right.
take a step and then gradually add on. And so Keep was built that way to bring customers in and then allow them to grow with us over time.
Okay. So if somebody's interested in trying Keep or Infusionsoft, what's the best way for them to do it? And are there any wonderful deals or offers that are available, the secret codes we can put in or anything like that?
Yeah, they should go to keep.com, KEAP.com. And there are resources on there. They can get a free trial. Lots of things you can get to learn about how to grow your business, but certainly to get a free trial. Or, you know, talk with one of our experts that can help you understand what's the right version of our software for you. But yeah, I mean, our purpose is to help small businesses succeed, and our mission is to simplify growth. We know it's really, really hard to grow a business, and it doesn't have to be so hard if you get a system that helps you to manage all that chaos and have everything in one place and follow up more effectively and automate the grunt work.
Awesome. So before I let you go, I would love for you to do two things. One, since you're reading 6 books a quarter, can you tell us maybe 3 of your top books that have had the most impact on you over the last couple of years?
Yeah, you know, one is a classic that I just reread that I absolutely love. It's called Made to Stick.
I just read that again myself. That's great, Collins.
Yeah, right? It is. It's great. I love it. And then one that I read that came out probably in the last year or so, Measure What Matters.
Yeah.
By John Doerr. Uh huh. Yeah, that's one that I really liked. And then I'd say there's one that I just read. It's a little small book called Hypergrowth that I liked from the Drip guys.
Oh, okay.
That's a good one. So
great. Fantastic. Thank you. And if there's anybody who wanted to get a hold of you, should they just go through Keep, or are there other ways socially or whatnot to get a hold of you to tell you wonderful things about how much they like Keep?
Yeah, you can always email me, clate@keep.com. That's the easiest way. And I'm always happy to talk to entrepreneurs. You know, I appreciate the opportunity to chat here and share the Keep story. You know, Scott and I hear all the time, oh yeah, you know, Infusionsoft went away. No, it didn't. Infusionsoft is here. Well, they just changed the name because everybody called it Confusionsoft. No, that's not why we changed the name. Infusionsoft still lives on as a product. We needed to create the simple, lighter version, and that's why we created Keep.
And totally makes sense.
And it's really all about that mission to simplify growth for 5 million small businesses. So
that's awesome.
That's what we're up to.
Congratulations on achieving mission one to Everest, and you know, good luck and best wishes on the way to Mars. That's fantastic. Thank you for being on the show today. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
You bet, Roland. Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thanks, Clay.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. If you're enjoying the show, let us know by subscribing and leaving a review. And for more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.